Today's episode is brought to you by Beachbody On Demand, which is an easy-to-use streaming service that gives you instant access to a wide variety of super effective workouts you can do from the comfort of your living room 24/7.
Your Honor, I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty.
They say a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 166. I am Thomas Smith coming at you from, because there is no such thing as vacation in a podcaster's life, I'm coming at you from my hotel room. So if I sound a little weird, it's because of that, but I'm hoping I'm able to make this sound good. Or rather, Brian will make it sound even better than my actual setup, in which case I'll be very, very frustrated. So that's me. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am doing great. I will be doing even better when our listeners take my advice here, which is when you're downloading this episode as you're listening to it, I want you to tweet at us at OpenOrgs, and I want you to tell us how much better Thomas sounds in this episode than usual.
the cost of setup that I'm on right now relative to my in-home studio, it's not like a little more. Like yeah. it's like a factor of 10 or more. So I can't wait. A bunch of people will be like, God, Thomas, your audio sounds so crisp and deep and amazing. It's warm, very warm. That's a word you like to use.
I did. I had people send in those comments for the episodes that we recorded when I was in Australia and New Zealand. And I took my good mic, but like I didn't have the pop filter on it. I was holding it in my hand. Like I was on the, you know, hotel Wi-Fi. Like it was the worst possible setup other than, I mean, I guess I could have been like running water in the background.
Or running from kangaroo, boxing a kangaroo while you got a snake on your ankle. But that's, you know what? What we love to do on this show is when we know a bunch of people really want to hear from Andrew on stuff like, you know, Michael Cohen and Alex Jones and Sean Hannity, we like to, you know, draw it out, make you wait a little bit, you know, just get the anticipation going. I am so excited for today's show. So excited, in fact, that we are coming at you hopefully early. We're recording early. We'll see by the time this, you know, there's obviously some brewing and manufacturing and parts and labor that need to go into it to get it to you. But we're hoping it's early. And that's because we're, you know, the news is nuts. And everybody essentially took to Twitter to say, Andrew, what's going on? So that's going to be today's show. So much cool stuff to talk to you about. We've got, you know, Stormy Daniels, Sean Hannity, we've got Alex Jones, and we've also got a really good listener question about WWE, so can't wait to get to all of that.
Yep. And the one thing I want to flag for you, despite recording early, despite the fact that we're going to probably go over our target of 60 minutes in this episode, because we do that in every episode,
pretty much.
There are still some cases that we can't get to that we are going to get to next week. We will get to in episode 167. And that includes the recent Supreme Court decision in which Neil Gorsuch sided with the four liberal justices.
One of those things that everybody's asking about. Okay, so
everybody's asking about Tuesday. You'll have to wait till next episode on that one. That gives you a reason to download all the episodes.
There you go. As if there wasn't already a reason to download all the episodes. All right. With that said, let's get to the show. Can't wait.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
First up, listener question. Gabriel Glitter asks, I'm a pro wrestler in training, so I know now... I don't know if that means like while the big WWE event is on, he's got like pillows that he's, you know, like doing moves, like watching it, you know, with his friends or something. I don't know if that means that or like actually he's in the minor leagues. I'm not sure.
If so, then when I was 12, I was definitely a pro wrestler in training.
There's like, a lot of
I used to suplex the heck out of my couch cushions.
Exactly.
I think Gabriel Glitter is his stage name. And,
oh, perfect. I was going to comment on that. Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. So I know some, back to the question, I know some of the inside working of WWE. The micromanagement of the behavior of WWE wrestlers goes further than you think. They are not even allowed to get haircuts without permission from WWE. One wrestler did that last year and was punished pretty badly for it. Yeah, so that's just, I guess it's a comment, but I'll extend the question to you. What are the implications on that level of control for contract labor versus actual employee labor?
Yeah, and I think that Gabriel's insight here is exactly correct. As we talked about on the show, the more control over the means that the employer or the party that is paying for services exercises, the more that the Department of Labor and the IRS both are likely to characterize that as an employment relationship. I do want to flag the other side of that, right? Like it is not to suggest that this test is dispositive, right? As we mentioned on the show, there are 19 different factors at play, and sometimes there are legitimate contractual relationships that nevertheless, it's important for the contracting party to specify precisely which means are being used, right? Like, and it's not hard to imagine. Suppose, you know, you have an environmentally friendly business, right? You might say, okay, I'm hiring you to paint the stripes of the parking spaces in our parking lot, but you've got to use environmentally safe paint, right? You can't park a like huge, you know, Hummer outside our building, right? Like, you know, it's critical to the identity of the business that you engage not only in the service, but that you do it in a particular way. So we've gotten a couple of other questions. I'm kind of amalgamating a bunch together here about, you know, well, what about my employer tells me to do X in Y way? Does that automatically mean I'm an employee? I do not want to suggest that just because they specify the means that that automatically makes you an employee. What I'm saying is that it's part of a complex of factors that goes into it. We talked about the rather large degree of control that the WWE exercises over its wrestlers. And so controlling their physical appearance is yet another really, really strong piece of evidence that I feel like we'll be doing an Andrew Was Right segment when the court determines that WWE employees are employees and not independent contractors.
Awesome. Maybe we can have some insert current wrestler name here to come on and congratulate you on your Andrew Was Right segment. We'll see if maybe Gabriel has some connections. I don't know.
Excellent. Well, thanks for writing in. I love the fact that the OA is big in the WWE minor leagues. So.
Absolutely. All right. Go Taint Team.
I've been in a fool that has to work the taint.
Oh, we're just going to be straight faced about our Taint Team. I can't help it. I'm sorry.
I love it when a case comes together.
All right, Andrew. It's one of the many things everybody's waiting for. Now, question. I'm in Chicago, as I said. Are we also on Yodel Mountain right now? Are we? That'll be the key question. Hey, and if people are confused by our references ever, which you're going to be because they go back a while and they're very confusing and we can't explain them every single show. But the Facebook group is a good place where people have like popped in and asked, hey, what does this mean? What is this reference? You know, what's armature? So that's a good place to go find that. Don't be afraid to ask because it's, you know, people have been like, oh, I was too scared to ask. No, these are nonsense things we're saying. So it's very understandable. But anyway, sitting atop Yodel Mountain here, what's going on with when we find out that Sean Hannity is the third man? He's the third client. And he's like, what did that mean? He's had a range of responses. I'm sure you're going to go through them. At first, it was like, oh, what? Michael Cohan? How do you spell it? Oh, yeah. Okay, I think I asked him at a party once about Judge Dredd the movie. So that must be what he's you know, he gave like a really weak answer. Like, oh, I think I asked him, you know, just some what I might have slipped him $10 and said this. So what's going on? So many questions. Where do we start?
Yeah. So I think we ought to start at why this matters, right? Mm. And the reason why it matters is not that Sean Hannity is corrupt. It's not that Sean Hannity has obvious conflicts of interest. That's all true, right? And
yeah.
I'm gonna link in the show. But somebody tweeted at us, right? Like, yeah, well, we look, anybody listening to Opening Arguments pretty much knows that Sean Hannity is a, you know, immoral, corrupt scumbag, right? Anyway, right? Like that doesn't help us. And so it will not surprise you to learn that Sean Hannity has had Michael Cohen on the show without disclosing the fact Cohen is
let me jump in to say, while that's not the bigger issue and that's all stuff everybody knows, we still need to emphasize that this is a joke journalistic enterprise. Fox News is a joke of a journalistic institute. And the fact that one of their main, you know, big stars was
their biggest star.
Biggest star was reporting on someone favorably without disclosing that kind of relationship. I mean, that's a joke. That's an absolute joke. So we all expect it, you know, because we have no expectations of Fox News. But I think it's important to still emphasize that that's, I mean, without saying he should be fired for that kind of thing, or the organization should suffer some sort of consequences.
Yeah. And I'm going to link a Slate article in the show notes about that contains screenshots and clips from Sean Hannity's coverage of the FBI's raid on Michael Cohen's office, which is, again, I disclose on the show when I have relationships with folks. I've done it, you know, over the course of our 166 episodes.
Oh, I thought you were just name dropping. Turns out there's actually a reason.
Yeah, look, like you want to say that when you offer an opinion about something of, you know, hey, look, like I represented X party in this matter. It is good practice. And, you know, the fact that it, let alone good journalistic practice. I will add, I retweeted out from the Opening Arguments Twitter page that a comment from someone that said, look, showing conflicts of interest are not what's going to change behavior at Fox. What's going to change the behavior at Fox is what affects their bottom line. And so, you know, if this is outrageous to you and you want to get behind the boycotts of Hannity shows, right? Like that's how to affect change.
Yeah,
over
that
at
seems
Fox
to
News.
Be working to a certain, I mean, it seems like it worked with O'Reilly. Seems like it had at least some effect on Ingram. I think she's still on the air, but I know she she let off one of her shows with, we're not going to have any commercial breaks today. It's too important, you know, the things we're talking about. It's like, no, you just have no sponsors.
Yeah. Unlike us, we tell you when we have sponsors or no sponsors on the show. Okay. So, yeah. And while we're still on the specifics of Hannity here, I want to say this is... The statements that have come from Sean Hannity were deliberately obfuscatory. Okay. Here's what he said via Twitter. This tweet I'm going to link in the show notes. It is still active, has not been modified. Michael Cohen has never represented me in any matter. I never retained him, received an invoice, or paid legal fees. I have occasionally had brief discussions with him about legal questions about which I wanted his input and perspective. Okay. And then his this is Hannity's spokesperson later published a statement that said that Sean Hannity assumed that those conversations with Michael Cohen were confidential. But to be absolutely clear, they never involved any manner between me, Sean Hannity, and a third party. So I want to parse through all that. I want to talk about whether that's an assertion of attorney-client privilege, because that was a subject of some debate.
Right.
But I want to point out something that so far nobody else has pointed out that I've seen, and that is that second statement by Hannity of, I assume those conversations were confidential, right? Now, that's different than saying I assume they were protected by attorney-client privilege, right? There are plenty of things. Every lawyer knows this, that there are plenty of things, for example, that my clients have that are confidential documents that Nevertheless, the fact that they're confidential does not protect them from disclosure, right? The classic example of that is if I represented Kentucky Fried Chicken, right? Their secret recipe, the secret formula for Coke, what, those are confidential documents. You would protect them from disclosure to the public via a protective order that would then require that information to be submitted under seal. But it's no grounds for me to say, I'm not going to turn this over to the court, or I'm not going to turn this over to the other side to say that it's confidential, right? So in other words, there's a distinction between confidentiality.
Well, that's it. Okay. But attached to that is something I'm curious about, and I'm sure I'm sure you were going to answer, but how did this come out? Because all I've seen is judge demanded that he say it, you know, who it was, but why? And like, if he... Because it sounds sort of reasonable, I'm going to play Hannity's advocate for a split second
here,
to say, you know, if he thought it was confidential, just like the KFC, you know, the colonel, whoever, whatever actor or actress is playing the colonel right now, would be like, hey, the judge just asked to reveal my secret recipe, and then all of a sudden it's all over the news. I thought that was confidential.
Yeah. So on April 9th, which was last Monday, that's when the FBI executed the search warrant and seized documents from Michael Cohen's law office. Okay. On Friday, the 13th, Michael Cohen went to the court, to the United States District Court for the Southern District, and moved for a temporary restraining order that said to the government, hey, we want you to stop collecting, sorting, looking through information. We want you to turn it all over to us, that is, to Michael Cohen and to his lawyers, and we'll go through the documents, we'll tell you what's relevant, and we'll give back to you documents that are responsive to the search warrant and not privileged.
Which, Monday, parenthetically, the very reason they were able to do this search was because there was enough evidence to suggest they wouldn't be scrupulous at that, right?
Right. That is exactly right. Look, essentially what Cohen petitioned for was a court order that would convert that search warrant into a subpoena. Mm-hmm. And in last week's episode,
we covered that already.
We covered that. We covered all the reasons why not. But that's effectively what that would do, right? The difference between a subpoena and a search warrant is in a subpoena, you, the target, are first complying with the request. And in a search warrant situation, the government gets to take the first crack at the request. The Donald Trump personally joined via letter in that motion on April the 15th. And in fact, and we're going to link this letter in the show notes, the Donald Trump's personal attorney filed a seven and a half page letter. This is Joanna Hendon, who also argued at oral argument, requesting that the court issue an order that, again, enjoined the government from going through the materials in any way whatsoever, and directed that those documents be turned over to Mr. Cohen with a copy to the president so that they could take the first crack at reviewing the documents, right? So that's why we were here. Cohen and the president wanted to take away the right to review the documents from the government. And their basis for asserting the right to take that away was, hey, look, you're going through a lawyer's files, and those contain legitimately privileged documents, and therefore we need to protect the attorney-client privilege, and that is such a compelling public interest that it justifies diminishing the utility of the investigation in this case. And so what that puts at issue, because the government's response back to that, let me take a step back and say, as long as you're playing Hannity's advocate, I'm going to play Michael Cohen's advocate here, right? And Hannity's advocate, and everyone's, right? Which is to
we're
say—
we're going to be on Fox News in a minute if we're not careful.
Yeah, call us. Laura, give us a call.
We'll go all Dershowitz on you.
Yeah, we could be bought. No, we cannot be bought. Our listeners know we can't be bought. But look, there is a legitimate, serious, and compelling public interest in preserving attorney-client privilege, right? And even in a situation where, you know, your client is a scumbag and your client is, you know, the target of an investigation such that you have convinced a sitting federal magistrate judge to issue a search warrant, right? That there's probable cause that he's committed a crime, right? Which is how they were able to get a search warrant against Michael Cohen. And that is, if Michael Cohen were my lawyer and were my lawyer in connection with the Mueller investigation, right? One of the things that I am very likely to want to talk about if I am a subject or a target of the Mueller investigation and Michael Cohen is my lawyer is, well, what happens if they do X? What happens if Y witness flips? What happens if they find out Z, right? That's the core of the strategy from which criminal defendants go to their lawyers to talk about, right? I want you to assess my case. I want you to tell me how bad does it look for me? What kind of a deal should I take, right? And to turn that over to the prosecutors is, in fact, if the facts were as I have just presented them, would be a very, very serious situation and would absolutely probably put me on the other side of this issue. The fact that I'm saying that strongly probably tells you what the next sentence coming out of my mouth is going to be, which is to say, those are not the facts here, right? Like Michael Cohen does not represent Trump or anybody else in connection with the Mueller investigation.
Yeah, he's not really, like, that's the thing. He's Trump's quote unquote lawyer, but not really. Like, yeah, he's not the attorney working on these things.
He is not only not the attorney working on these things, but he is, as far as I can tell, not really acting as a lawyer at all.
Yeah, yeah.
and again, let me give an example of that, right? Like, I have clients who have podcasts, right? And I often give those clients business advice relating to how to grow the podcast, how to set up your business, how to do this and that. All of that business stuff is not attorney-client privilege, right? Like, I can act as a business professional, and indeed many, many lawyers and many C-suite executives in companies have both a legal component to their job and a business component to their job. And the government's response back to all of this was to say, essentially, look, we've had, this is also an interesting piece of information about the investigation. They said, we've had wiretaps on Michael Cohen for months. We have additional information.
we know what he's working on or not working
on. We've intercepted his emails, and this dude isn't doing any legal work. and that is essentially what the government's response said was,
wow.
This is not a lawyer doing legal work. This is somebody.
It's a criminal doing crime work, basically. Yeah,
that's exactly right. So then Cohen wrote a follow-up letter on the 15th, on Monday, in which his lawyers, and again, since we have made fun of Michael Cohen and we have made fun of some of the lawyers that are attached to some of these issues, Michael Cohen's lawyers are with the firm of McDermott, Will & Emery, which again is a multi-thousand lawyer, international Covington & Burling style white shoe law firm. His lawyers are unimpeachably good at this point, which it makes it fantastic that there have been rumors floating that Cohen is going to fire the McDermott Will lawyers and represent himself, which would just be, you know, people were tweeting our intro quote
about
us
a fool for a client.
Yeah,
right?
I am that fool. Yeah. So Cohen's own lawyers represented in print that since Donald Trump's election, for the 10 years prior to the inauguration, from 2007 to 2017, Michael Cohen was employed by the Donald Trump Organization, right? So he had no clients, right?
Okay.
From 2017 until now, they say that he's had 10 clients, right? But they then, again, Cohen's own lawyers said, of those 10 clients, 7 were probably not law clients. 7 are clients for which there was probably no privilege that attached. So now, mind you, that's the guys arguing on Cohen's behalf.
On his side, yeah.
right. Those are the guys that are paid to be in his corner. So, you know, journalists were like, okay, 10 minus 7, that's 3.
Uh-huh.
We know 2 Michael Cohen clients, right? The president, Donald Trump. Republican strategist Elliot Broidy, This came out, was named in the letter and came out last week, who paid $1.6 million to cover up an affair with a Playboy playmate that resulted in a pregnancy, and as a result, used the exact same agreement, complete with the same pseudonyms, David Denniston, Peggy Peterson, as the Stormy Daniels agreement. So that's the second client. And I want to be clear, there are different questions that are at issue in whether this agreement as applied to Elliot Broidy is per se invalid or whether it may be a legal agreement. Right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because again, he wasn't running for office. There's no clear connection to the violation of the campaign finance laws. It may just be a scumbag deal.
That's right. One of those legitimate payoffs.
Yeah. And look, we talked about that on the show, right? There are matters where it may be legitimate to compromise claims and pay to keep someone quiet. So Broidy was client number two. And then the question was, who's client number three? And there was colloquy back and forth in court. And ultimately, there was the statement by Michael Cohen's lawyer of the third client is Sean Hannity, which then led all of the journalists in the room to immediately take to Twitter and announce that. It is not difficult to draw an inference here.
An inference like who's the third David Denniston is what you
Yeah, saying? Exactly right. I mean, look, like we there is.
It seems to be his one note thing. Like, yeah, it's not like he's got a, you know,
that's his area of
handling
expertise.
His estate or.
And Sean Hannity is an exceptionally wealthy public figure who, through the same spokesperson, has said, I have eight lawyers on retainer, right? And I have no doubt that that is the case, right? Like, Sean Hannity has met hundreds of lawyers who have tried to pitch him business over the years. He works concurrently with at least eight lawyers by his own description. It is difficult to imagine why, if you were Hannity, you would have an attorney-client relationship with Michael Cohen. But again, you know, that's speculative at this point. The nice thing is that we have some evidence, and again, if you're a journalist, I wrote the question for you out on Twitter, but we'll repeat it here on the show. If you're a journalist, you should be asking Sean Hannity, did you ever sign an engagement letter with Michael Cohen? When you said, so that's question number one.
Okay. He'll just say no, because he's a bullshitter.
Great. But again, and then question number two, when you said, Mr. Hannity, when you said you thought your conversations with Michael Cohen
Hillary's emails
were confidential.
She killed somebody.
Attorney-client privileged?
Because that's all he would do.
Yeah. Did you mean attorney-client privileged? By confidential, did you think that the attorney-client privilege attached to those conversations?
And then if he said, oh, no, it was just – if he sticks to his Twitter story, which is, oh, no, just a couple questions here and there, like nothing big.
This is why this is a perfect giving kind of a little bit of a lesson here on how to give cross-examination if you're a lawyer. The perfect question is the one that you're prepared for either answer. So if Sean Hannity says, no, I did not. I thought they were confidential, but not attorney-client privileged, then now those documents can be released, that you have a firm denial and waiver of any attorney-client privilege.
Who would release them, though?
Anybody could. Journalists could release them. There's no – in other words, there is no –
why would they have them is what I'm saying. So like right now they're in the government – hands,
the government can now attach them to pleadings without having to
just to mess with them.
Yeah, well, no, like as evidence, as part of the public record, right? Oh, they can make it available to FOIA requests. And remember that the existence of privilege is the argument for why Cohen and or Trump need to intervene here. Well, now, if they're not privileged, then they can report back of, okay, well, you know, we seized 85,000 documents and 84,997 are not privileged, right? And we know they're not privileged because the person who holds the privilege, right? Privilege is held by the client, by Sean Hannity. So the attorney can't waive the privilege, but your client can. And so if Sean Hannity says, no, I did not think these were privileged, then the government can add those to the pile of not privileged.
Yep. this is interesting because now I almost wonder, like, I can't wait for you to tell me I'm wrong, but I almost wonder if Gasp, Sean Hannity could be the one telling the truth here, because would it be that they're just trying to bolster, like, could his legal team, could Cohen's legal team just be trying to bolster the claim that there's a bunch of privileged stuff here? And so this was an attempt to say, oh yeah, all kinds of clients. Well, all right, these ones are kind of nothing, but these three are definitely something. Or where do you put the probability?
That is absolutely the case. I'm really glad you went there. That it's why I bracketed with error bars on the, you know, if he is a client, then it's probably a David Denniston type situation, just as an inference. But absolutely, it could be the case. And the way in which that would come up is that Michael Cohen has lied to his lawyers at McDermott, Will & Emery and overstated the degree of legal work that he's done for Sean Hannity. And that's why, that gets you to the other fork of the question, right? So Hannity is now going to have to choose between protecting his friend and the president, right? And saying, oh yes, I thought privilege did attach, which I'm going to get to in a second, or saying no, right? So we went down the no branch. What happens if he says yes? Your third follow-up question, and again, journalists, I hope you're taking notes here, is, okay, what legal work, what legal opinion did you seek from Michael Cohen? What area of work did he perform for you?
Well, I mean, I'm sure he'll just say no comment or something. But,
you can say no comment, but one of the things that is going to happen as a result of the hearing on Monday is that the government is going to prepare what they call a privilege log. Okay.
Well, wait a minute. What's the hearing on Monday?
So this hearing on Monday was over the request for a temporary restraining order by Michael Cohen.
Already happened. Oh, yeah, that happened on Monday. I thought you were talking about an upcoming thing.
Nope,
sorry.
Nope. Past Monday. I will tell you what's upcoming. But that hearing was on Monday and that was denied.
Denied, yeah.
And the court said, no, we're not going to put the target of the investigation in control of which documents the government gets to see. We are going to require that the government turn over copies of its documents to you so that you can see that. And we are going to require the government to produce a privilege log, right? That is to say, to identify documents that the government thinks are privileged and therefore not appropriately the subject of production to itself. Right. And the way in which that happens is via what we call a taint team. So it means this. Yeah. This is not an explicit episode, so we're not going to go through.
Just going to be straight faced about our taint team. This is an actual legal term.
It is actual legal term.
Legal dorks.
Yeah. And what you do is you put another layer of lawyers that are not working on the Michael Cohen criminal investigation in between the documents and the prosecutors, right?
I can't help it. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
The taint team is, you're saying it's a team that's in between lawyers and the okay.
Right.
Gotcha.
It serves to separate the lawyers who are prosecuting Michael Cohen from the.
I feel like I know which end of the taint team Sean Hannity is, but. All right. This lawyers, is not an explicit show. Right. Okay. Taint team. They're totally normal legal things.
The privilege determination. And seriously, you do this all the time. It used to be called, this is now no longer a remotely appropriate term, but it used to be called a Chinese wall. So I guess going from Chinese wall to taint team seems more more politically
these days. Immature joke is way better than racism. So they're just like, all right, close enough.
And I think I'm with them on that, right?
So it's like the Futurama joke where they changed Uranus to Urectum.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So right now there are lawyers busily at work who have nothing to do with the investigation, who do not care about the substance of the document in any way whatsoever, who are reviewing documents to determine whether they are on face privileged, right? And they
go taint team.
Yes. And they will apply the standard test, right? Which is not just, is a lawyer copied on this? Because we know they're Cohen's documents. Obviously, they all are. It is, does the material seek legal advice from an identified client? And if it does, then they will prepare what's called a privilege log, which is an Excel spreadsheet that just has columns for the author, the recipient, any copies, the subject matter, title of the document, when it was issued, you know, basic information like that. So
this seems to me is to be the obvious, the very rational way to go about something like this, where you want to respect attorney-client privilege, of course, but you've got a criminal who you've proven to a judge, or at least given enough evidence to a judge that, hey, we can't just let this guy. It's like asking, you know, I don't know, Al Capone to decide like which evidence to give us or something.
It is exactly, if I can jump in, it is exactly in a callback to our What Was So Bad About Watergate episode, right? That it was what made Nixon's proposal first to review the tapes himself, and then second to have, you know, deaf racist Senator John Stennis review the materials. Right. You don't want those materials to be in the hands of the person that you think has likely committed
but at the same time, it's pretty tyrannical to just say, now the government will decide, you know, like the, so they have a taint team.
of
people who are disinterested parties, I guess. And they can say, okay, this seems to be privileged information.
Yep.
Or not.
That's exactly right.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Okay.
So that's the underlying legal basis. There is still pending the request by Cohen, which was joined by Trump, to appoint a special master. And let me explain what that is and what that would do. From a strategic perspective, if you're Michael Cohen, the first thing you want to do in this investigation is destroy evidence. Right. So you'd like to be the one in charge of the documents and what gets turned over. You lost on that. So your fallback position is, well, okay, if I can't destroy evidence, I would like to slow this down as much as possible. I would like to delay and obstruct and make it difficult. And in particular, if you're doing that because you're trying to front for the president, obviously, you know, there is a clock that can be run out on the president. So,
And especially trying to get this stuff delayed till after midterms, because, you know, the more Democrats have to run on the midterms, the worse.
Exactly right. So a special master is typically in the federal courts, it's a magistrate judge who is not the presiding judge in the case, who is then appointed to handle discovery disputes. Right. And this is a procedure that I see all the time in my day-to-day job, civil litigation. It's particularly in huge cases, right? I had a 9-year-long insurance coverage case, and we produced millions of documents. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to overburden a judge who has 500 cases on her docket over the course of the year, right? If all of a sudden now all of those cases, all of the questions about documents had to go to the presiding judge, right? Like literally only 2% of cases go to trial now, and that would be 0.002% of cases, right? So you appoint a special master, and the special master gets to hear all of the disputes. So as you can imagine, if you were to appoint a special master in this case, it would insert a level of bureaucracy in between the government and Judge Kimball Wood, who is presiding over this matter. And the government would be able to file a ton of these motions, get hearings on them, right? The government would have, you know, the special master would have to review the document. It would delay things, right? And so Judge Wood's order on Monday was for the government to proceed with the use of the taint team to prepare summaries of the document, to upload all of the material into a database that attorneys typically use, that will then, you know, scan and sort the documents and, you know, be able to tell us. So we will know of the documents seized by the government, right? How many pages that entails and what percentage of those documents belong to the three people that have been alleged to have been clients of Michael Cohen.
Right.
And they'll have to turn over that database, summary database, to Cohen's lawyers, right? And so Judge Wood says, after the material has been uploaded, we will know more about the volume and the content of the documents, and we can make a more intelligent choice as to whether a taint team or a special master should be involved in the process of determining what is and what is not protected by attorney-client privilege. This is more from Judge Wood's rulings. I envision a test. As soon as we see the documents, I want a proposal for how to move quickly on this. So there you go. That's how we're going to go forward. The next step in this process is going to be the government's production of a summary of the status of the documents to Michael Cohen and to President Trump and presumably to Sean Hannity of how many documents are there, how many identify your particular client, how many identify particular attorney-client privilege, and what's the test? How are we going to go forward and ensure that the attorneys within the DOJ who are potentially prosecuting Michael Cohen do not get to see documents that shouldn't get to see? And again, I want to go back to that bottom line, right? Like, I'm a lawyer. Attorney-client privilege is super important to me.
Yeah.
And I do not want us on the left to race because, you know, Cohen is, you know, a fixer scumbag and we want to bring down President Trump. I do not want us to race to the point where we are blithely turning over attorney-client privilege materials to prosecutors.
No, we all understand the importance of the taint team. We get it.
There you go.
We're right there with you.
All right.
So I'm curious where you think, just personally, what you put the odds on. Who's lying? Cohen? I mean, we know all these people are lying all the time, but in this particular instance, who is lying, Cohen or Hannity? And it's funny because I would have thought going into this, I would have thought, well, of course Hannity is bullshitting here. But I don't know. Like now it sounds like, okay, maybe there's a chance that, you know, they were just trying to bolster the case for attorney-client privilege. But I don't know. I'm still like 60-40 Hannity. What do you think?
I think I'm going to go the other way. So we could actually make this. You'll take that you think Hannity is lying. I think it is more likely than not that Cohen lied to his lawyers. I do not believe. I don't think the McDermott will lawyers are not going to the mat for this. Not certainly not in light of Alex van der Zwaan's sentencing. Right? You would not. These firms, right, like Covington and Burling, I've told the story of, you know, how few lawyers are left from my incoming class. The turnover rates at these mega firms are enormous, right?
Yeah, you're saying there's no way the firm's in on this lie.
There's no way the firm's in on the lie.
So it's Cohen. But that's sort of one of the reasons why I lean more toward Hannity, because here's why is, you know, again, just my guess, but I lean toward it because I don't know what Hannity adds that the other two didn't already have. You know, like if we're talking 10 clients and you've already admitted 7 are bullshit, then it's like, what, you know, how much difference is it between 7 and 8 and saying, okay, well, 8 were not really anything and 2 were something? Like, it doesn't seem like the Hannity one adds much.
And here are the two things that I think that it might add, right? So number one is it could just be numbers, right? It could be volume that, if there are a ton of communications.
Oh, like the documents themselves, how many.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's going to be part of this ratio, right? And the second is, look, we know that there is organized coordination from the White House to Fox News, right? That the evidence for that is abundant. If Michael Cohen is one of those conduits, if there are thousands of emails from Cohen to Hannity going, hey, can you emphasize this on your show today? That is a pretty good reason for all of the parties involved to want to mischaracterize the nature of the relationship. So that would mean...
I mean, but that's still obviously not... That wouldn't be attorney-client privilege anyway, though.
Yeah. No, it would not be attorney-client privilege, but it would explain both Hannity's kind of totally deceptive answer, but without implying that Sean Hannity has a mistress that he has paid off. A Peggy Peterson, so to speak.
Sounds bad. I'm pretty 50-50. Honestly, I really feel like it could go either way. But I'll take Hannity. You take Cohen. We'll see. So talk about, will we get a definitive answer to this? And when?
The next, so we will get a definitive answer. We should get the next step very, very quickly. The government will. It does not take long to scan and OCR these documents and upload them into Concordance or an equivalent database. And the software will automatically output the headers, you know, will populate that table. So they'll be back in court. We will know, I would suspect, in a couple of days, maybe early next week, what the volume of documents are and what percentage is potentially privileged. Because keep in mind, right, that that was, it's why I read the last part of Judge Wood's order. The government and the court in this case are most concerned with how do you keep a criminal investigation expeditiously moving forward. So the government kind of has to walk this fine line of, yes, we're protecting your rights. We're not going to accidentally include some privileged documents, but we're still going to get it done quickly. And if the government falls down on the job of getting it done quickly, they know that's going to play into the arguments of the other side, right? Because then they're not going to be able to come into court and complain about the delay of establishing a special master because Cohen's lawyers, I've made this argument in court many times, Cohen's lawyers are going to be like, look, it took you guys, you know, 6 weeks just to upload the document. I'm sure if we appoint a special master, I have every confidence that this court will be able to oversee this process faster than you have, you know, and you look pretty bad. So I think we will have every incentive for the DOJ to populate that data quickly, and this story is going to keep moving. It's part of why we're recording today. So,
all right, we'll add that to our fantasy teams, yeah. And then I guess Chris Christofko can have they're both telling the truth or something.
There we go.
We'll get tally it up.
Yeah.
All right, man, that is some interesting stuff. I'm so glad that we are recording early. That really answered a lot of questions that I had. So. I want to make sure I absolutely with my interruptions didn't stop anything you were saying. So the part that you were saying nobody else is reporting on, what was that specifically, just to clarify?
Is just parsing the overly careful language that Sean Hannity has used in describing his relationship with Michael Cohen. And let's go back to that. I'm glad we're going to end on this. Right?
Yeah.
Michael Cohen has never represented me in any matter. I never retained him, received an invoice, or paid legal fees. Okay. That's the no. Then the I'm holding the door open, though. I have occasionally had brief discussions with him about legal questions about which I wanted his input and perspective. Well, look, journalists have brief discussions with me about legal questions about which they want my input and perspective all the time, right? Because I'm a lawyer with a podcast and, you know, journalists call me up and ask me to explain stuff to them. Those aren't attorney-client privileged matters. That is not seeking legal advice from me.
Right.
Right. Asking a lawyer a question is not the same as seeking advice. In fact, one of the tests in the model rules of professional conduct is that you must be engaged in a relationship between a client and an attorney. In other words, not as friends, not hanging out over the backyard fence. Right. And related to that, then the statement put out by the Hannity spokesperson is looks to me like it was drafted by a lawyer and drafted by a lawyer to be deliberately evasive. So I'm going to read that one. Hannity assumed those conversations were confidential, but to be absolutely clear, they never involved any matter between me, Hannity, and a third party. And again, asserting confidentiality is not the same as asserting attorney-client privilege. So those are the questions that I want. And it is still, despite the fact that Cohen's TRO was denied on Monday, the request for a special master is still pending. There are still issues to be resolved, and it is in the interests of the public's right to know in this case for that debate to not allow for overbroad assertions of privilege, right? The more potential privilege is attributed to Michael Cohen, the stronger the interest is in derailing the government's investigation. So we want to be clear. We do not want somebody to be able to make a mealy-mouthed statement like that that implies simultaneously that he was and was not a client of Michael Cohen's. it to me, and again, and I had a debate with a lawyer on Twitter, cordial one, but a debate with a lawyer on Twitter about this, where, you know, to me, this reads like a waiver of privilege. To him, it looked like the potential assertion of privilege. And I think the issue is that, is the deliberately evasive word confidential? So that's what we need to pin down. Interesting. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. He's like, well, we not attorney-client privilege, but we were walking through a hall and an episode of Law and Order was on TV while I was with him. No. All right. Well, thanks so much for breaking that down. That really did clear up a lot. And I'm excited to see which one of us gets a little boost to our fantasy teams, whether it's Cohen or Cohen or, well, actually, we'll give Christofko the taint team. He can have the taint team. We'll have you have Cohen and I have Hannity as the liars. So
he gets a whole team.
Like, yeah, but the taint team, you know, that's a bust. They're a draft bust. Yep. They're never gonna lie. They're the taint team. Andrew, this is a really cool thing. This is awesome. Beachbody, by the way, is the same company that's behind P90X and Insanity and 21 Day Fix and some other ones. I have been doing P90X and Insanity for years. I'm so excited that we get to advertise with these guys.
Yeah, I am excited. As you know, as I think we've shared with our listeners, I'm, you know, in the process of trying to lose weight. So I'm really excited to have Beachbody as a sponsor. I have gone through, so like it's pretty cool. Like what you do is you get access to this online portal, right? It's Beachbody on Demand. Mm-hmm. And then when you log in, you get to pick your fitness level. You get to pick the time, the type. If you have like favorite trainers, I know you do. Like, yeah. I don't, but like, ooh,
see, I love Sean T. I love Tony Horton. I'm sure they're all great, but those are the ones I've used before.
Well, I'll give you my opinion on Tony Horton, cause I'm going to do the Tony Horton program. What I like the best, cause you know, I have a sedentary lifestyle and career, right? Lawyering and podcasting is
There's not a lot of running involved in what we do.
And doing the show twice a week means that I don't have a whole lot of time to do, to do other stuff. So like, yeah, like the P90X is great, but that's like if you've got a spare hour a day. I do not have a spare hour a day. But Tony Horton has the 10-minute trainer.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do that. It's a 60-day program. We're going to check back in 30 days and see how I'm doing.
Listeners should do that as well. And what I think you're touching on that's so great about this is rather than have to decide on like, which is the best one for me? Do I do this one? Do I buy this, you know, set of DVDs or some nonsense? It's like, no, you can do Beachbody on Demand. And then whatever's going to fit with your schedule, whatever's going to fit with your particular fitness goals, you can just get access to any and all of those videos whenever you need them. I think it's a great idea.
Oh, yeah. And let's be clear, right? Like this contains, when you log onto the portal, it contains videos that you can stream anywhere, right? On the computer, I'm going to use it on my iPad, right? You can do it on your smartphone, on a web-enabled TV, like a Roku box, like all that sort of stuff. So you can put it on, you can watch the programs. You can also download, it's got a little tab where you can download the written materials. So it tells you, you know, what you need. Each program has like dietary advice under it as well. Like it's really, really cool. And you know, for me, like I feel pretty good about this one, right? Like, so I clicked on fitness level and my fitness level is not great. We all know that. I first clicked on beginner and I was like, no, I need beginner/intermediate, right? Like the beginner was, I mean, I really feel like, you know, my grandma could probably handle some of the beginner stuff, right? Like it was really about.
So it
like,
gives you all the range you could need of where you're at, sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was awesome. Very excited about it.
Yeah. So guys, try this out and it's awesome. Right now you can get a special free trial membership. If you text OA to 303030. That's the phone number there that you text to is 303030. And just text OA and you get that free trial membership. I think it's a great idea. And one of the best things is I love Sean T because he'll kick your butt in all these workouts and there's no equipment. Like there's no doodads or, you know, bungees or anything. Like there's so much different stuff you can do to get in shape. So if that's something you're interested in, make sure to text OA to 303030.
And we're going to check in a month. I will be able to tell you what I think of Tony Horton, and we'll see how each of us are doing.
Awesome. Sounds great.
I came knocking on your door a million times, and you laughed at me. You've been in love with something else your whole life, and this is a love affair. And so I'm not going to get in bed with you because you don't love the spirit of justice. You loved your father, the devil.
So, Andrew, we have gotten so many questions about this Alex Jones lawsuit because the victims and the victims' parents of the Sandy Hook massacre, and I think Charlottesville, I guess, are suing him for just perpetuating these awful, awful conspiracy theories about how, oh, the kids were crisis actors and the shooting never happened. Stuff that, you know, I feel like 4 years ago, this kind of nonsense was out there, but we didn't have to hear about it much. Like you could just kind of pretend it wasn't there along with a bunch of other really terrible stuff. And then someone who like has been on Alex Jones's show is elected president. And then it's like, oh crap, we need to pay attention to this. And it's unfortunate, you know, Alex Jones has actually a pretty big platform. So he's been sued for some of these really just awful, horrendously evil conspiracy theories that he's pushing. So what's going on there?
Yeah, there are now three, I suspect there will be more, pending lawsuits against Alex Jones. We presently have access to one of them, which is the one I'm going to talk about in some detail. So let me briefly talk about the first two that have been filed in state court in Travis County, Texas, Posner versus Jones and Heslin versus Jones. I am trying to get copies of those complaints. They were not available as we went to press. So I have to go with the media characterizations, and I want to put large error bars around that. Those two were brought by parents of victims of the Sandy Hook massacre. You'll see the overlap in a minute, and they relate to allegations that Alex Jones has voiced on his show, the Sandy Hook truther conspiracy, that all of this was shot in front of a green screen with the open complicit participation by Anderson Cooper. There's this, like all good conspiracy theorists, that they there's a glitch in the video that has to do with the compression rates, right? Well, because again, right, like these are being shot on iPhones, and then when you upload them to CNN, which by the way, if you watch CNN, their quality of their feed is a little different than the quality on your iPhone, right? You compress and decompress the data, and you get little glitches. And Alex Jones and his, you know,
which also happens when you stage a massacre.
Yeah, and that's what they're saying, is that this was done in front of a green screen, and that all the kids are actors, and you know, so that there's no, you know, there was no massacre. It's all just done as a plot.
Do I even need the green screen at this point?
Yeah. As a plot by the deep state to take away your guns.
Something.
Right?
Yeah.
So no, it's true.
Something.
Yeah. And I want to add parenthetically, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the air. I have, I've briefly interacted with the 9/11 truther world because
you have mentioned this. This is the weirdest story. Yeah.
I went to high school, with a girl named Liz Wainio, and she was one of the victims of the Pennsylvania flight. And as part of the vast 9/11 truth or conspiracy, you have to pretend like that flight doesn't exist, right? Like,
right.
So you can't pretend like the Twin Towers didn't exist. So they have all that, but that was all just made up. Right. And so all of the victims are now, you know, cheap Photoshop forgeries or whatever. And so there are entire pages out there about how, Liz was a Photoshop creation based on the fact that, you know, this was the late 90s, early 2000s. She was not a public figure. And so there weren't a whole lot of pictures of her out in public circulation. And so they all look kind of similar. They all had a similar hairstyle and expression. And, you know, it was just mind-boggling.
Must be the deep state.
I mean, and looking at these, where the conclusion of the argument of the conspiracy argument is why I laughed along with your, you know, therefore something. I mean, that literally the argument was like, look at how similar this picture is to this picture. So come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
So like, what?
Yeah. I mean, literally that's all that it is. It's just,
so therefore, you know, we had to do it so that we could go to war with not the country that did it. Yeah. And then whatever. Yeah. It's
right.
Nonsense.
Right. Anyway, we don't need to debunk 9/11.
It's nonsense. We all know it's nonsense. And so but what I'm curious about with this lawsuit is, we do have the First Amendment, so yep. I mean,
no, and this—that's absolutely what I want to talk about in this okay. segment. I want to set the stage first. So Posner and Heslin, those are Sandy Hook parents. The lawsuit that we have that I'm going to upload, you can read for yourself. That we're going to talk about in a little more detail. That is related is a federal lawsuit. It's filed in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Virginia. So I was able to pull it off the court's website. And it is Brennan Gilmore versus Alex Jones. And it is not related to Sandy Hook. It is related to a different conspiracy theory that Alex Jones was peddling on his show, as were others. Brennan Gilmore was the person who witnessed the neo-Nazi James Alex Fields Jr., who drove his Dodge Challenger into the crowd of protesters at the Charlottesville counter-protest to the Unite the Right rally, right? And he recorded that on his iPhone and then obviously circulated that to reliable news outlets of, look, here's where we are. We're at the point where the Nazis behind this rally got in and deliberately murdered peaceful protesters, right? And Heather Heyer, I shouldn't say murdered plural, murdered Heather Heyer. She was the only one who died. Others were injured. He caught this on video. And so now the extreme right's conspiracy narrative around that is, nope, this was all orchestrated. It was all planned out in advance. And as it turns out, Mr. Gilmore had previously been involved in Democratic politics. He was an employee, is presently an employee of the State Department. And so they said, look, yeah, no, these are the Democrats that are getting together. And, they drove the car into this crowd and wanted to frame neo-Nazis to make us, right. Another one of those, yeah. Be careful what you're arguing. So those are the factual situations. Again,
I love the deep state conspiracy to make Nazis look
to make
bad.
Nazis look bad. Right. Yeah. And so all three of these are lawsuits brought by people who have either been defamed by Alex Jones or parents of people who have been defamed by Alex Jones, arguing defamation, right? And arguing that peddling conspiracy theories is actionable defamation, and that the harm includes two different types of harm. I should say, let me take a step back and define the elements of defamation, right? It's not just saying something false about somebody, right? In order to defame someone, first let's talk about the elements, right? So what you have to do is you have to have a defamatory statement, right? It must be a false statement of fact. It must be either negligently or intentionally communicated, that is published, made to somebody else, and it must cause injury or damage to the person about whom you said it, right? So I can say a false thing about somebody, I can do it intentionally, but if it causes that person no harm, that's not defamation. The law doesn't care. You have to be injured before we will find a tort remedy for you. And this is one of our many longstanding principles of the show. Now, certain statements are considered defamatory per se, right? That is, you don't have to prove that there is an
injury.
This
is where that old-fashioned language comes in, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
What was one of them? It was like, I can't remember now, but it was something really old-timey sounding.
Yeah. As a noxious, infectious, or terrible disease has committed a serious, notorious, or immoral crime, or sometimes referred to as crime of moral turpitude. Or is incompetent in his job, trade, or profession.
Right.
So, and then you you got actually to what I think is sort of the jumping off point of this discussion for this segment, and that is the question of what you have to prove by the level of activity of the person making the statement, right? And so you can prove one of three things against a private person, right? And that is that either the person making the statement against the private person, right? In this case, if Alex Jones were to issue a conspiracy theory against Thomas Smith related to something other than opening arguments, right? Related to your hockey play, right?
Sure.
You can come.
I'm pretty famous for that, but I guess not enough.
Not famous enough, right?
Okay. Fair.
Or your taste in clothing, which is awesome, by the way. But you know, Alex Jones, massive conspiracy theory. You could then prove that either Alex Jones knew the statement he was making was false and defamatory, or that he acted with reckless disregard as to whether it was true or false in making the statement, or that he acted negligently in failing to ascertain whether it was true or false before making it. Right. And you see that third one is a much broader category than the other two.
Right. So my memory is when you're talking about just your neighbor. And right. So we go on our show and we say, I talk crap on my neighbor. Right. There's a very low bar. You know, that's not protected because this is just some guy. Whereas the bar is higher. So which part in which way is the bar lower when it's a private person?
So how do you mean lower?
Well, because you just named those three things, but I thought those applied no matter if it's public or private.
They do. And so right. if it is a public figure, you lose the ability to prove the third one. You lose the ability to prove
defamation. So the addition of that third broader thing is the key.
Is what protects
for a private person.
Right. And we have previously described that it is in my view, a good and salutary thing under the First Amendment, that dichotomy exists, right? That we want robust public debate about public figures, and we want robust public debate about what are called limited purpose public figures, right? So for example, you know, if within a particular community, you have a reputation, you're not famous, you know, Beyonce famous in general, but you and I, for example, are famous for as a limited purpose public figures within the area.
Damn straight. We're number six or something on the list of best podcasts according to somebody.
There you go.
Something. I don't know. Something like that.
And that's right. And look, so what that means is if people are talking about opening arguments, it's why I made that carve out. That they can say horrible things about us with respect to opening arguments, and it's going to be very difficult. Yeah, please don't do this, guys, if you're listening to the show.
Can't wait.
But here's
my question, though. Here's what I really want to get at that I just realized, and I hope the answer is a good one, but I doubt it.
Right.
When you talk about these Sandy Hook parents, they didn't ask to be famous. You know, they didn't ask to be a public figure. They're not getting paid. They're not celebrities. They're not singers. They're not actors. They're people whose kids were shot, and therefore now I guess they're in the public eye. But what I'm worried about with this kind of thing is, in my mind, if Thomas gets to be in charge of the law, I would say, all right, you don't get to just say whatever you want about someone who's thrust unwillingly into the spotlight because their child was killed. Like, that doesn't make them a celebrity. That doesn't make them a public person who you can say whatever about. They didn't choose that. They're not benefiting in any other way. Because it seems like the logic of it somewhat, maybe you'll tell me this is wrong, but somewhat is, well, if you're a public person, you're benefiting from that already. And there's consequences to that as well. Like, there's a downside to it, which is people can say you had a monkey baby or something if you're Hillary. But like, when it comes to these victims and these victims' parents, I would hope that they aren't just considered public people by the nature of being a victim of something and then people talk about it. But is that how it works?
So I'm glad you put the question that way, because that's exactly what I wanted the jumping off point for this segment to be. Here's the language that the court uses, and we could talk about specific cases applying it, but I think it probably makes sense to kind of talk to the principles. Courts have said a limited purpose public figure is someone who has thrust himself to the forefront of a particular public controversy in order to influence the resolution of the issue involved. Okay. So how does that cut across? Like, right, take the Sandy Hook parents, right? You are the victims, right? Are you a limited purpose public figure when you go on the news to talk about the need for gun control in light of the fact that your child was murdered? Under the case law, I guess.
Like if you're going on the media to talk about it, but I don't think these conspiracy theories have been limited to just the people who have gone on the news to talk about gun control, have they?
No, but in my view, this is where I want us to kind of have the discussion, because in addition to folks who were trying to influence the issue one way or the other, it passes the voluntarily thrusting yourself to the public eye test if you are a citizen journalist, right? Like, and so let's go back to the case of Mr. Gilmore. What he did was recorded this horrific incident on his cell phone and then spread it to news agencies, right? So he engaged in the voluntary activity. If you think about when this doctrine took shape, it was the mid-1970s, right? Well, how did you get to be a public figure or a citizen journalist in the mid-1970s?
Oh, yeah, you had to buy a giant camera or something.
Exactly, really. The Zapruder film, right? I mean, you got to be out there, you know, intentionally engaging in a level of activity that from which we can ascertain sort of that, well, you know, you kind of brought this on yourself.
But now everybody's got a phone.
Everybody's got one. And this lawsuit, the Gilmore lawsuit in particular, makes mention of that in the predicate, in the initial opening paragraphs, and says, look, like people are out there. They have a camera, you see something, shocking, and then you want to disseminate that information. There is no argument. It would do you no good to argue before a trial court that you should change the definition of limited purpose public figure, because trial court is bound to follow the law set by the Supreme Court of the United States. But I think this is a discussion that is worth having right now. And that is it the same? Are you really opening yourself up to this level of potential attack from huge media outlets with millions of dollars behind them, hundreds of thousands of viewers, as a result of these conspiracy theories? Like, people have been physically attacked, right? Like, people get death threats. Alex Jones, you know, has motivated people to go out and commit crimes against other human beings, and I think it's worth starting off that question of, and I mean, I suppose there are really kind of like two philosophical questions here, right? Like, the first is it time to rethink what it means to be a limited purpose public figure? And is it time to start, right, at the way in which laws get changed, the way in which jurisprudence gets changed, is people start talking about that. People start talking about it in law review articles. So I know we have law students who listen to the show. I want to point that out. I mean, I want you to think
give
about
them
it. And
some
have
homework.
That, yeah. Have that conversation. And secondly, I never thought I would say these words. I did not say these words a year and a half ago. And you've heard me describe myself as, you know, a First Amendment near absolutist. The underlying motivation for the First Amendment, for its broad protections on free speech, comes from one of my favorite philosophers, a utilitarian named John Stuart Mill. And he wrote an essay called On Liberty in 1859. And Mill, in that, again, you think of 1859, right? Like, the country's 100 years old, right? Like, Locke was formative to the Constitution. Mill was writing 100 years later as the country was sort of struggling for an identity. And he articulated this defense of free speech. And he said, "The peculiar evil of silencing an opinion is that it is robbing the whole human race, posterity as well as the existing generation, those who dissent from the opinion, still more from those who hold it. If the opinion is right, they are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clear perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error." And this has been, in the past 150 years, right? That's called the marketplace of ideas defense, right? The idea is, let people say false stuff because you pitch truth up against falsity and truth wins out. And, you know, you're shining a light into the darkness. Watching the state of the news right now, watching us having a president who will say something and then later in the same press conference say, well, I didn't say that. About whom you confront with reliable reporting will say, fake news. And 30% of the country will nod along and, you know, keck along with. I do not know. I mean, I'm not saying I'm willing to throw Mill under the bus yet, but I'm saying, boy, I don't know that Alex Jones has produced a livelier and clearer perception of truth by spreading conspiracy theories about, you know, Hillary Clinton chopping up and murdering and raping children in the basement of a pizza parlor with no basement. I don't know that that's the case. So,
yeah. That's a giant discussion that should be ongoing and will never be resolved probably. But that's kind of how I feel as well. It's like, you know, when people talk about freedom of speech and how fundamental it is and all that stuff, I agree. But I also know that, you know, there's places where you can face punishment for certain egregious levels of speech where you don't hear. And it's not like those societies are collapsing. So it's like we can entertain the idea that maybe the protection is too broad, but I'm sure we'll hear from a lot of fundamentalists and maybe they're right. I don't know, but this is the kind of thing where I think at the very least, I think you should have a case against Alex Jones. That's my guiding jurisprudence is someone should have a case against Alex Jones for the level of harm he's causing. I just don't know what that is.
And I want to say, Gilmore, again, I've got to read, and we will do a follow-up on this segment because, you know, we're starting a conversation. We got to read Posner. We've got to read Heslin. I am concerned that as parents of victims of the Sandy Hook massacre, that they will be limited purpose public figures. They will be held to the higher New York Times v. Sullivan standard, and that it will be a challenge for them to argue that they have suffered compensable injuries as a result of the defamation. I suspect that's where the fight is going to be. Gilmore's complaint presumes that he is a public figure, right? Because he's been active in Democratic politics, and you know this is so he bites the bullet on that one and says that Alex Jones meets that standard, that he has acted with actual malice, with either knowing falsity or reckless disregard of the truth, and can show not only actual damages, but this is the approach that I imagine that the other two cases will go, but that there is the allegation that it is defamation per se. He's being accused of committing a serious, notorious, or immoral crime, which is to say, masterminding and fabricating the murder of Heather Heyer in order to get gun control, right? And so I think Gilmore here is going to carry kind of the laboring oar. His case looks pretty good on paper, even at the New York Times v. Sullivan standard. And that's going to then sort of shift the battlefield. Look, the one thing, I mean, it's why we always go back to Bat Boy, right? From the National Enquirer, if you're engaged in walking the line between defamation and reporting, you know where that line is, right? And look, yeah. you know that on the positive end, right? Like we had the Cy Babe on who talked about how she walks that line when she calls, you know, various quacks quacks, and then, you know, talks about rendering clear opinions as opposed to factual statements. So, you know, the purveyors of scandal, of conspiracy theory, are going to be watching and are going to be tailoring their actions. So this is, in my view, this is just the beginning. But it's time to have a conversation. It's time to figure out like what we can do when wealthy and powerful media outlets can say things that are just demonstrably false. And when you read the Gilmore, so we don't have the time to do it, I encourage folks to, if you scroll down to page 45, that's where the counts begin, and start reading some of the individual allegations against Alex Jones. I mean, it is things that, you know, where Alex Jones has said, well, this is a disgruntled former employee of the Department of State. And then the response is, Mr. Gilmore is still presently employed at the Department of State, right? Like, I mean, it is just things that are blatantly false, right? That where the right. factual, there's no, you know, opinion. Did I call you a douchebag? Right now, these are out and out falsehoods, and you have somebody who does not care. And, you know, that's the law is meant to provide a remedy when somebody does not care that what they're saying is whether what they're saying is true or false in furtherance of their agenda. So,
all right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. We have gone long, but that's okay.
Sorry,
man. This podcast has so much valuable information every week. Every show. So, but we've got to get to one of our favorite segments. I mean, easily tied for first.
1A.
And that is thanking our top patrons, our Hall of Famers over at patreon.com/law. Thank you so very kindly to Heather Loveridge. Matthew and Elisa are eloping as we speak. Nice. Congratulations. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. Marcus Stroman's earned run average. Jeremiah Holzbauer. The one thing you cannot afford to have is a sense of proportion. Anonymous, the vengeful ghost of attorney-client privilege.
I love that. Nice.
Chief Justice Michael Cohen. Oh, my God. Linad Rekab, the Russian Michael Cohen. Greg Sullivan, Trump run undone once lump sum funds to dumb tongues see sun. C6 Sarah, Sammy, Roger, but the sign said all you can eat Metcalf v. Frying Dutchman. Rhonda the Dork, Reagan Klein, Reasonable Risk Podcast, our first patron Danny Rosari, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking, Occam's Chainsaw Massacre, the Wayward Willis Podcast, Philip Stromberg, a prenup is a contract, right, and Andrew is good at contract law, comma, and I'm sure there's some more to it, but it gets cut off. Tricicular Manslaughter, CampQuest.org, 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 Squickfinger, Someone Else, MH World, Purge the Pickle, Impeachment Countdown, 31 Weeks to Go, Red Tie Crimes, Lot Awful Movies, now featuring Captain Freedom. Thank you guys so much for those pledges.
Yep. And thank you to Bigglesby, Larity, Patty O'Flaherty, Mickey O'Malley, Catche, a poorly named user, Malika Chandler. Thanks to Peasants with Pitchforks and Glow Sticks, Saul, Kevin Graham, James English, Jim Grove, Dave, backup goalie on Thomas's second chance hockey team, Nichols. Thank you to I Am the One True Thomas Smith, You Shall Have No Others, Ian and Allie. I'm a good baby and everybody loves me. Oh, that maybe baby opening arguments got on.
Yeah.
Patreon should really give us a character count. I agree with that. Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Foxhole Atheist, Soggy Pants, Cosmos Vigilante, Alec Emke, Adam Lenda, Aaron Grady, Sakashite Fukasumi can cling film a pug to a tree, but nothing larger. Larger than a pug or larger than a tree? Anyway. Frederick Alstromer, Michael Rops, Mitchell, Liz, the Duchess of Crakenthorpe Weeks. Do you get that reference? I don't get that reference. Sorry.
No.
Stop okay. Breaking the Law, Asshole. No reference this week, just Eric. Well, we still love you, Eric. Midvale School for the Gifted. Push only. I hope the Tigers finish the season with more wins than TTTBE. And Conrad Michaels, our top patron. Thank you all so much. Thanks for supporting the show. If you want to join their ranks, head on over to patreon.com/law and pledge as little as $5 an episode, and we will read your name, hilarious, offensive, whatever, every single week. You know you want to join this group. Come on.
All right. And I'll give you a little technical advice. So we do the export from Patreon in order to access all our patrons. And when I do a length formula on the Excel spreadsheet, it allows 64. Oh. So that's the length that you get for both the first name and the last name each.
Yeah.
So you might be able, I think some people may be able to leverage the first name a little more.
Yeah.
Not to give any, you know.
That's
to further extend the segment, but people, that's where people are going wrong. They're typing like one thing in the first name and then all the stuff in the last name. So
yeah, 128 total characters. That's basically an old school tweet. We'll read out an old school tweet in this section, right?
Yeah, pretty much. That's true. All right. Well, now it's time for another favorite segment, because lately the bar exam has just seemed too darn easy, but I'm sure it'll catch up to me. All this cockiness eventually will get to me.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
TTTBE, here we go.
All right, Thomas. A landowner executed an instrument in the proper form of a deed purporting to convey his land to a friend. The landowner handed the instrument to the friend, saying, "This is yours, but please do not record it until after I'm dead. Otherwise, it will cause me no end of trouble with my relatives." 2 days later, the landowner asked the friend to return the deed to him because he had decided that he should devise the land to the friend by will rather than by deed. The friend said that he would destroy the deed, and so a day or so later falsely told the landowner that the deed had been destroyed. 6 months ago, the landowner, who had never executed a will, died intestate, survived by a daughter as his sole heir. The day after the landowner's death, the friend recorded the deed from him. As soon as the daughter discovered this recording and the friend's claim to the land, she brought an appropriate action against the friend to quiet title to the land. For whom should the court hold?
I feel like this is a good one for me to get wrong.
Yeah, yeah. It's real property questions.
We've had a lot of easy ones, and now it's like, I don't know what most of this is happening here.
This is, as I've said before, all of the principles of real property law are like leftover from 13th century Saxony. This is tough.
All right. I'll get in the mindset.
Yeah. We'll read Paddy O'Flaherty, Mickey O'Malley's name.
Yeah, I was thinking like Robin Hood for some reason. I don't know why.
But. All right. For whom should the court hold? A, because the death of the landowner deprived the subsequent recording of any effect. B, the daughter, because the friend was dishonest in reporting that he had destroyed the deed. C, the friend, because the deed was delivered to him. Or D, the friend, because the deed was recorded by him.
Oh, man. Yeah, this is getting into the technicalities of what a deed exactly means and does. All right, I'm having a hard time in terms of elimination. I mean, it's easy to just guess one, but like, but when I get to eliminating two, which I usually do, that's where I have to actually have a logical story. But unfortunately, every single answer seems to have a decent story to it, and I'm not seeing too much rhyme or reason that would link them together in a way that will allow me to eliminate two. I would say I'm gonna eliminate B, which is the daughter because the friend was dishonest in reporting that he had destroyed the deed. I can't say exactly why, but I feel like that's not the right answer. I feel like it's not, like, it doesn't fit the question. Like, why isn't the land his? Oh, because he's dishonest about it. It should be because the guy's dead or because he said not to. Not that he was dishonest. Like, the way it frames it is his dishonesty is why he doesn't get the land. Seems weird to me. I can't wait for that to be the correct answer and me to be totally wrong there. But it's just one of those things that doesn't, my finely tuned legal instincts are telling me that that's not the right answer. And then, I mean, I'm kind of strongly leaning toward A, which is the daughter because the death of the landowner deprived the subsequent recording of any effect. That sounds like it could be right. Like, it doesn't, you know, if someone dies, it doesn't make any sense that they could record a deed to convey land to somebody. But at the same time, I mean, I could imagine a scenario where, you know, something's in the mail and someone dies and then it is delivered and it was, so maybe C and D are very similar, with the only distinction of because the deed was delivered to him versus because the deed was recorded by him. So that's like one of those things, like if you have physically, is possession 10/10 of the law here? In that if he has the deed, then it doesn't matter what happened, versus just merely from him recording it. God, I'm having a hard time thinking of what the meaningful difference of those would be. So maybe that'll lead me to eliminate both of those. How about I just screw it? I'm going to eliminate C and D, and I'm just going to go with A, the daughter, because the death of the landowner deprived the subsequent recording of any effect. I'm just going to hope that that's the rule in 13th century Saxony. I don't know, who knows, but that's my answer.
All right. So you're not eliminating a second one, but you're choosing A as your...
No, I eliminated C and D.
Oh, okay. Got it.
I'm saying they're too close together, so I'm going to go with it, as has been the case sometimes. I mean, not always. When they're too similar, like there's not a meaningful enough difference. I'm hoping that means they're both wrong. So we'll
got see. It. Okay. All right. And as always, if you'd like to play along with Thomas on TTTB, we've had a lot of participation lately, and let's keep that up. It's been fun. We have really enjoyed reading your guesses and especially the humorous ones. So you want to play along? Here's how you do it. Just share out this episode either on Facebook or Twitter. Include the hashtag TTTBE. Include your answer and your reasons therefor, and we will pick a winner and announce that person on next week's episode and shower them with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right, that's it for the show. I want to, you know, I of course thank the listeners, thank the patrons, but you know what? I want to thank Andrew for this week, this episode, recording a day early, doing 80 something minutes of just nonstop action. Andrew, seriously, this was a really great episode. So much good info. Thanks for doing it and getting it to the people early.
Well, thank you. And thank you for you're out on vacation and recording from the hotel room. So
let's face it. OA is a vacation. I love this show. So, all right. We've all thanked each other. Yep. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law. Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
All right, go Taint Team!
I've been in a fool that has to work the taint.
Oh, we're just going to be straight-faced about our taint team? I can't help it, I'm sorry.
I love it when a case comes together.